With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to another Curzon Film Podcast. This week, hair-raising intimacy in Sebastian Lelio's Disobedience and raising heirs intimately in Alfonso Cuarón's Roma. Plus, our very own arthouse spin on a book at bedtime. Sharing in these stories with me this week, we've got Kelly Powell.
Hello.
And Sam Howlett.
Hello.
How are we doing?
Very nice, thank you. It's a cold, windy, rainy day.
Yes.
In foggy London town.
Yes, but that means it's perfect weather for going to the cinema, doesn't it?
It is.
So let's start by talking about Disobedience. This is the new film from Sebastian Lelio, who is just coming off of an Oscar win for his film A Fantastic Woman in the foreign language category. If listeners want to, they can actually go back in this very year and listen to our podcast with Sebastian all about that film. But Disobedience. When her estranged rabbi father suddenly passes away, Ronit, played by Oscar winner and co-producer of the film, Rachel Weisz, returns from New York to the North London Orthodox Jewish community that rejected her years previously after a scandalous transgression. So before we get into this film, what were you thinking anticipation-wise? Because I know just coming off of the back of Gloria and A Fantastic Woman kind of paid on a promise of that film. And this one seems where there was a five-year gap for Lelio between that, and, or 4 years. This one's come very soon after. And we've got another Lelio film coming in 5 months as well.
Yeah, very weird. When I spoke to him in March, he'd obviously finished Fantastic Woman for a few years, and he'd finished this for about a year. And he was just filming Gloria Bell, which comes out soon. So yeah, it's very rapid-fire career heightening.
Yeah.
And this is really, really different from A Fantastic Woman and Gloria.
Yeah, this is his first English language film. That's the big change. And then Gloria Bell, interestingly, is an English language remake of Gloria, which is the film that kind of put him on the international stage as well. And maybe within that four-year gap, it was maybe not a case of spending 4 years on A Fantastic Woman. It was almost, it feels like maybe there was a five-year plan. And like, there were a few things bubbling away. Kelly, did you see A Fantastic Woman?
I did, yes.
Yeah. So what were you thinking coming off the back of that about Lelio? Are you excited for what's coming next?
Yes, I am. I haven't seen Gloria. Fantastic Woman was the first one I saw. But it seems to be that he's, I mean, although that this is a different film, it's dealing with kind of a strong woman at sort of the center. I'm assuming Gloria is similar.
Yeah, very much so.
He's obviously got themes that he likes to stick to
and
does quite well. And yeah, I think this one for me was highly anticipated. I think, you know, there was a lot of buzz early on. It's premiered at TIFF, I think.
Yeah, but that was last year.
So
it's had a long lead up, and audiences may not know that it's got a lot of BIFA nominations, British Independent Film Awards, that are happening this weekend, and that's come out in the last few weeks. And so it's had this really, really long lead. It's already come out in America and been well received over there. So it'd be interesting to see how people take to it over here, particularly after that foreign language win for A Fantastic Woman earlier in the year, because there's a lot riding on this. And it's interesting that Rachel Weisz is a producer on it too.
Well, she kind of spearheaded getting it back up. So I was listening to a podcast with Rebecca Lankovich and Naomi Oldman, who Naomi wrote the book and Rebecca adapted it with Sebastian. Mm. I think they co-wrote it.
Yeah.
She was saying that the book was optioned a bit before when people had tried to make it, and then she sort of forgot about it and didn't think it was going to get made until she got contacted by Rachel Weisz.
Right.
Yeah, and she kind of was the driving force behind getting this sort of made. And then sort of took it from there. I think she was passionate about the subject matter. And yeah, it shows. You can tell that it is kind of like a passion project for her. And she's incredible in it.
She is really good. So Rachel plays Ronit Krishka, who is at the start of the film a very cool photographer in New York, and then he finds out her father's died, but she's kind of been rejected from the community that raised her. But she travels back to London to the Orthodox Jewish community to try and pay her respects to her father, really, and grieve with. The family and friends who she was raised with.
Mm. I think it's simultaneously she was rejected, but she also left.
Mm.
I think it was it's important that she chose to leave.
Well, you get this feeling that she doesn't miss this community at all. Mm-mm. Or this way of life. Because obviously, so we haven't really mentioned the fact that she reunites with her childhood friends, Dovid, played by Alessandra Nivola, and Esty, played by Rachel McAdams, and they are now married. Mm. She has a former relationship with Esty, and that's where the kind of the conflict lies in this film, why she left in the first place. But throughout the film, she's constantly talking about how oppressive this culture is for women, and she's sort of, you know, making fun of Rachel McAdams for carrying this granny trolley around doing her shopping in, and only wearing these long black clothes and the wigs that...
Well, the modesty element, yeah. The shaitel, it's called a shaitel.
Okay.
Jewish women, when they're married, wear wigs. Just for modesty purposes. But I think she's got this sort of modern attitude, you know, very much anti sort of the oppression of women in this kind of religion, but she's still got a tendency. It's really, I think this film does really well in sort of showing both sides. It's like, yes, okay, this religion has these really hectic elements that can be seen as oppression, which I think sometimes is. But they also show the tenderness and the community spirit, and you know, especially when someone dies in the Jewish community, everybody comes together, everybody cooks for each other, and it is like a week long period of mourning where people come together and are supportive of the family. And you do see that, even though she's kind of on the outside of that in the beginning.
Yeah.
Alienated from it.
And I think that's really important for her character and for the film, that you have someone like Rachel Weisz who can kind of cut through the tar of it as well. Mm. Like that it's not, she's not stilted, like the dialogue isn't completely whispered and done in dark corners. Mm. Like she's very happy to be quite abrasive and importantly quite funny about it. That's actually makes it more damning. In those awkward dinner moments, it's not just being angry and flipping the table and trying to make a statement like that because people think it's childish or something.
But
it's
muttering under her breath.
It's facing someone and being able to laugh about it makes it even worse. I think Weisz handles that really well, and she doesn't get used comically enough. But we're seeing this. This is not exactly a comedy performance, but it's important that element is there. And The Favourite.
Yeah.
She's excellent in that as well, and that's going to be out in a month too. And two really, really well-balanced, dramatic, but funny roles from her. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think she's really good in this. And I think, Rachel McAdams, I think she has the hardest job to do in this.
Definitely.
Yeah. Because she is so oppressed and quiet, and has kind of been assimilated into this routine that at one point she was quite happy to reject.
Well, I don't know. I think I had a feeling. I mean, because it's not explicitly said what happened, why she left, or because I mean, Esty, you know, still exists in this community, and she married Dovid. And I think at one point they do say that her family, she is kind of like Rachel Weisz's character, Ronit, and Dovid were her family sort of as a kid.
I think in the book they're cousins, Ronit and Dovid.
Okay.
That's not really expressed in the film, is it?
No, I wouldn't get that.
But in the book, they are cousins.
Yeah. Right, well, okay. David...
But like, there's a family feeling.
Yeah,
to them,
totally.
The way
totally.
They act with each other. Mm, yeah.
And you do kind of feel like Estee's sort of relied heavily on that.
Mm.
And so when Ronette left, you know, obviously her and David were left behind. And she's still accepted in this community. So you don't know if everybody knows that it was their relationship,
yeah.
You know, because I don't know how accepted she would have been if she had been outed,
yeah,
basically,
yeah,
back
yeah.
then. But yeah, she's definitely the one that you kind of feel the weight of all of these
yeah,
sort of
yeah,
past
yeah.
decisions, and she's got to straddle the line of being, you know, a good Jewish woman, a good Jewish wife.
Yeah, it's very interior. She feels.
Yeah.
I mean, Rachel McAdams is not exactly a big person, but she feels so small in the frame.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It's those big coats. It's the wig. Because
yeah.
the wig is quite big. She's got a relatively
yeah.
small face, and this idea of framing
yeah.
it and constantly yeah. reducing her.
Yeah, exactly.
And the
yeah.
moments when she takes the wig off is really well constructed. Like,
yeah.
It's only with her husband.
Well, yeah, when they're together in the bedroom.
And then
that's
later
the only time.
With
Ronette,
yeah.
yeah, exactly. When they have their moment together. And then at the end, I think she's not wearing it at the end.
Mm. So yeah, does these things that are part of Orthodox Jewish culture, but then like using them dramatically, like the wig and like the fact that David can't touch another woman other than his
yeah.
wife, the way they use that,
yeah,
I think is really well done. And phrases like at the funeral, because I asked you about this earlier, like,
yeah.
may you live a long life.
Yeah.
It's like a thing you say to someone when
yeah.
someone's died,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, yeah.
But there's the way they say it to run it at the home. It's very much like, please go away. Kind of, may you live a long life.
Mm. Yeah.
The way they say it, it's kind of like, please go away and never come back.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
then when run it and Estee say it to each other later, it's actually really lovely.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it's tender.
Yeah. And I think Nivola's great in this as well. He's not
yeah.
like a rasping villain.
There's
something of a Sean Harris-ness about him that I quite
Sean
like.
Sean Harris.
Yeah. I'm not sure where that... But
your
that was,
mission,
yeah,
Mr. Hunt,
yeah.
should you choose to accept it?
I think Nivola for a future MI villain, for sure.
Well, he's played a villain. He was in Face Off.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
He's Nicolas Cage, his brother.
Okay, well, resurrect it. Let's get him for Face Off 2. So, just a couple of things before we wrap up on Disobedience. I think the music's really interesting. It's by Matthew Herbert, who did the music for A Fantastic Woman.
Mm-hmm.
And at times it's a bit weird. It's a bit incongruous. It's like almost fantastical and dreamlike. And I wasn't quite sure about it for a long time. But ultimately, with where the film sits at the end, I went for it. It won't be for everyone. And I think there is this disparity between the image and sound at times. But I'm all for it.
It's a choice.
Yeah, it's a bold choice.
He's made a choice.
Yeah. And fun fact, if anyone wants to check out the music video for Matthew Herbert's song Battle on YouTube, at 5:03, you will see a certain podcast host driving a Nissan Micra.
Well, Kelly, you're driving a Nissan Micra.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Yeah. Okay. So let's move on to Roma. Now, this is the most personal project to date from Alfonso Cuarón. It follows Cleo, a young domestic worker for a family in the middle-class neighborhood of Roma in Mexico City. Delivering an artful love letter to the women who raised him, Cuarón draws on his own childhood to create a vivid and emotional portrait of domestic strife and social hierarchy amidst political turmoil of the 1970s. So, does anyone want to set us up with where we are with Cuarón up to this point? Because it's been a five-year gap.
So, this is his eighth film, I believe, and possibly you could call this his fourth masterpiece.
After his segment of Parish Attempt.
Yes. Okay. And Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. Yeah. I'm gonna include his four masterpieces as Itu Mama Tambien, mm-hmm. Children of Men, mm-hmm. Gravity, and this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's fine. I think Azkaban's the best Harry Potter.
So do I.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, so, I love Azkaban. Yeah.
So, as a 21st century blockbuster.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Top
right
tier.
Right up there.
Yeah. And so, yeah, going from Gravity to this on paper, it looks bizarre to go from a hugely technically complicated special effects blockbuster, which is like 90 minutes long, high concept, George Clooney and Sandra Bullock, and he won Best Director.
When I heard about Rome, I thought that's like classic ego auteur project, just using all that money.
I know,
And then it felt like a bit of this could be a Knight of Cups or something.
Well, I had that in my head. I had Tetro, the Francis Ford Coppola film, because it was also a black and white, and he's like, I'm going back to my roots, I'm making a black and white film about my childhood. And then I heard, you know, when people say, oh, this is my most personal film, I often kind of roll my eyes and think, oh, here we go, like, just sort of using fame to excise your own demons and just kind of tell your story. And I think, oh, who cares? But this is actually incredible film of the year, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, my. It's probably one of my favorite of the last decade, to be honest. Wow. Honestly, no, seriously, I think... I don't know, sometimes these films come along, and it has been a while since one of them came along, that you just kind of take your breath away, and you don't know how to explain it, it's just a feeling. And yes, you can pick it apart, and it's excellent on so many levels, but I don't know, this film is just magnificent. I loved it so much.
Yeah, it is a remarkable feat of filmmaking. Let's go in with the very first shot. Because I think this is where it sets your pace as a viewer. It's just a drain amongst some tiles, and very slowly you can hear water sloshing closer and closer to it, and the voices in the background, and dogs and aeroplanes. And I think the take is probably a good 3 or 4 minutes.
Mm. It's the full credits, isn't it?
Yeah.
All just over this one shot. And it's a great piece of audience manipulation in a way, to tell you, right, here's how to take this film. Mm. Here's how you sit with it, literally let it wash over you.
Yeah.
Because this is not going to be fast. Mm. This is not going to be action packed, but just sit here and go at this pace.
Yeah.
This is the rhythm.
Mm-hmm. And there's such a rhythm to this film. Mm. I mean, he said before in many interviews that this film was made from his memories, basically. And there's this almost, it's like a flow, like an emotional flow that ties these moments of memories together, that kind of does lull you into this. It's very slow in the beginning. The first hour is like extremely, you know, the pacing is slow, but it picks up slowly towards the end. Not for any kind... there's a bit of action, but I don't think that that's the main point. Mm. I think as we sort of have come to love and see the world from Cleo's point of view, you're invested.
Yeah.
You
know? So Cleo is played by Yalitza Aparicio. First time performance.
I know.
What is that about?
Yeah.
Incredible stuff. It's really, so you spoke about this is about Alfonso Cuarón's memories of his childhood.
Yeah.
Really, it's not, though.
No, it's not.
It's about Cleo, who is based on the woman who he says, the women who raised him.
Yeah.
And it says his mother and Cleo,
who's like a domestic worker.
Yeah. Real life, her name is Libo.
Who the film gets a dedication to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it's told through her, really. She's who we focus on, and it's through her eyes that we get to know the family. And the film is set up with the father of the family leaving, and Cleo getting into a relationship with a younger man. And those are the main story threads of it.
Yeah.
It's like the family kind of dealing with the fall apart of that, whilst Cleo is also dealing with her own romantic entanglement.
Yeah.
And in the backdrop of that, you've got the student protests that became quite violent. But again, that's none of it is really pushed to the forefront and say, like, here is the plot. It all, as you say, it drifts.
Yeah, it just contextualized this world that they exist in, you know. It's like, I listened to something where he described it as, he wanted the camera to feel like an observer, as though a ghost from the present were visiting the past. And so it does feel like, I mean, every piece of, you know, mise-en-scène in this film feels so real.
Yeah.
He took so much time to reconstruct this world that he grew up in.
Well, they couldn't build the set because they needed to find the right house. Yeah. And then this house they found, and it was going to be demolished. So they just paid rent on it.
Yeah. Amazing.
The production designer, he said, this is like a unique opportunity because if it's going to get demolished, we can really do what we want with it and treat it like a set. So they were knocking down walls, building fake ones, as if they had this set, but it was actually this amazing Mexican townhouse.
Brilliant. I love the house. I love how
so great.
There's so many weird little parts of it. Like, the layout is so weird. The fact you've got sort of the driveway that is, like, properly in the house. And this whole thing of the fact the car that can't really fit in the driveway, and the dad's meticulously working how to get in, and the mum tries it later and just smashes
No, the car's such a great...
The car's a great motif.
All throughout,
And, like, all the bookcases, the weird sort of sliding doors, the fact that the dog poos all over the floor, and the sort of the workers' quarters as well, that looks... You can see through the window,
The workers' quarters, I think, are really interesting because he basically puts any scene with Cleo and her friend that work in the house, he puts the camera in a corner facing outwards that never moves, whereas any scene in the house is full of light.
Yeah.
It's interior. It's looking into the house, and any scene from Cleo's room is looking out of the house and always trapped in it. It's just this really simple stuff, and it's not doing stuff that perhaps in something like Children of Men, where he's drawing attention to his craft. Like, he would say that he's not, but I think some of
water spatting on the lens of the camera.
Yeah. Like, you're very aware of the technical achievement that's going on, whereas this doesn't feel like that at all. And interestingly, it's Cuarón shooting the film himself. His regular cinematographer, Manuel Lubezki, wasn't available. And he thought, he's the only other person I would know that would be able to bring this vision. Yeah. So now I've got to do it myself. Which is very cool.
Very cool.
And you think, maybe just carry on doing it this way. It seems to work. It's a beautiful film.
The camera work is so sort of so elegant, and the way it can take in everything within that frame, without, like you say, without making you aware that it hasn't cut for however long. It's just so, like, smooth, and the way it sort of cruises around corners, and the way it frames people's faces. The film is black and white, but it really you don't remember that.
No,
it feels like it's in colour. It
was built to be that way. So again, the production designer they had to rethink how do we redo the colours of this house, because as much as if we did it by Alfonso's memory, it might look beautiful, but those colours, if we shot them in black and white, they're not going to look right. So we've got to figure out, like, light pink and light blue are just going to come out white, so we can't. It's meticulously done without ever feeling like it's been constructed. And going back to the idea of representing Cuarón's memory, you get these little nods to his work, moments that might have inspired bits. Like, they go, they watch Marooned with Gregory Peck, and there's this close-up of a floating astronaut. But it feels authentic. It doesn't feel like
gimmicky,
a two-wing... Yeah, exactly.
I think that shot of the astronaut is, like, half too long.
Right.
It's a little bit like, oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
I think it should just be a little bit, and then you get it later.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It lingers a little bit. Anyway.
I think there's a few bits like that, but there's a bit where the student protests, the violence escalates, and I feel like that's shot in a particular way that is addressing that's Children of Men.
Yeah.
And there's a moment with dinner happening on a beach, and that feels like that penultimate scene of Itamama Tambien, yeah, which is an amazing scene. It's really nice to see this DNA of a filmmaker, yeah, being translated, yeah,
and
so well.
And the werewolf is obviously Prisoner of Azkaban.
Yes, yeah, big bit, yeah. Mm. That was just a boggart, though. All right, so that is Roma, one of the films of the year, which is available in Curzon cinemas. So do try and check that out.
Yeah,
if
it's
you
out
can.
In cinemas for a few weeks before it goes to Netflix on December the 14th.
Yeah.
And Disobedience.
Disobedience, that's going to be out in cinemas and on home cinema from this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
That gives you 2 days to watch it ahead of the Biffers on Sunday. So you can say that you were there first. Talking of Disobedience, there's a special feature on home cinema about that?
Yeah, so on Curzon Home Cinema, we've got an interview with Sebastian Lelio, who is talking about the use of London in the film, and you're sort of walking around the areas of London that he finds, you know, most sort of inspirational, influential in the film.
Brilliant. Yeah, and also on home cinema, there's a few new additions. Actually, the one that most caught my eye was There Will Be Blood, which is, I mean, a bit out of nowhere, but just great to see that.
The year's best film.
Yeah. just 11 years anniversary, I don't know.
Yeah, we got it, and because I had to test it, and I ended up watching like most of it. It's so good, I can't turn it off.
Yeah, why would you? And for those looking for a bit more content on Roma, we love content. Kelly's going to do something for the blog as well, which is going to be up on Friday. So keep your eyes peeled for that. Now, we promised at the start that there was going to be a bit of a book of bedtime vibe for this episode of the podcast. And that is because a few weeks ago, we ran a competition for the release of The Workshop for people to send in short stories that would get them the prize onto a creative writing course. And we've actually got the winning story to read out on the show. And not just the story, the writer, Toby Norways, who's written Brixton Sunset. And I'm going to pass over to him now to give a lovely reading of his winning short story.
Brixton Sunset by T.S. Norways. This train terminates here. All change. Jostled, hassled, bustled. Homebound traveller, southbound chin. Escalator, oyster, bleep. Classical music, piped incongruous of the bleep, bleep, bleep of the ticket hall. Scale the stairs, exit left. Brixton Road, bustling bus queue buses. Left at Iceland, Electric Avenue. The world's population on my doorstep, the world's produce on my street. Sold from under awnings, behind the clash of metal shutters, amongst the clash of cultures. Papaya, pineapple, plantain, aki, ugly, pawpaw, eucalyptus, sandalwood, and jasmine, wafting on the steam from curried goat. Traders debating Lara and Tendulkar in language both local and foreign. Farsi, Cockney, Hindi, red pepper, yellow pepper, green pepper, Rastafari, red, gold and green, white pepper, black pepper, white yam, yellow yam, sweet sop, sour sop, yellow murder board, R&B, hip-hop, ragga beats, non-stop, black bin bags and grime, drum and bass, beat, beat, beats, a street pulsating to throbbing woofers and barking dogs. You are without salvation! Metallic shutters scream shut in the fading sun, but the fire of the Lord still burns. The word of God sallies forth from megaphones and Baptist lungs as disinterested sinners shut up shop. Sidewalks strewn with trampled fruit, the stench of red snapper and red mullet hosed away by fishmongers swigging red stripe. Pavements of wolf whistles and melting ice cubes where displays of fish no longer fresh run in rivulets to the gutter. A Babylonian tide carries me home, to my door, my key, my solitude.
Thank you, Toby. And if you want to check out more entries into that, you can check them out on the Curzon blog. If you've got any thoughts on Disobedience or Roma or any other recent releases, then let us know by emailing us at podcast@curzon.com. We'll read those out on next week's show, or you can always tweet us at Curzon Cinemas as well. If you have been enjoying the show, then please subscribe if it's your first time. You can do so on iTunes and Acast. You can listen to us on Spotify as well. And across all of these, if you enjoy us, please leave us a review or a comment. That would be wonderful. Next week, we'll be talking about David Lowery's The Old Man and the Gun, as well as speaking to the director himself. Kelly has raised her fist in celebration.
It's a great film.
It's a really, 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 really good film.
Yep, I'm so excited to get into that one. In the meantime, if you want to keep up with us, you can follow Sam on Twitter at...
SamHowlett_1.
Kelly, we want to follow you on Letterboxd.
Yeah, KellyP3EE on Letterboxd or KS_Powell on Twitter.
To keep up with your viewing habits. And you can keep up with me at Jake H. Cunningham if you so desire. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.